Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
We already have 100 million people who are unlikely to get a good job and remain stably employed. Why? Too many jobs require tech mojo, communication savvy, emotional intelligence, plain old brain power, and they got to be machine-like in their reliability. After all, machines can replace ever more jobs. And many more jobs are going to be offshored. What's a country to do? Trying to tackle that question, really thorny question, in his latest book, the book's called Who Owns the Future, is one of Time Magazine's Time 100 in 2010. He was named one of the world's top 100 public intellectuals by both Prospect Magazine and Foreign Policy Magazine, and one of history's 300 greatest inventors, this guy's a polymath, in the Encyclopedia Britannica for his work on basically founding the term, and a lot more than founding the term, virtual reality. Since 2006, the guy's been a key member of Microsoft Research. It's kind of Microsoft's little insider think tank. He's a guy who I really like for his intellectual agility. He's not unduly constrained by the status quo, nor by conventional wisdom. I also hear he's kind of a fan of KLW. Anyway, Jaron Lanier, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Well, hey, thanks to have me. It's always great to be here.
Good. Okay. Now, you say that a major reason for the decrease in good-paying jobs is the availability of free information. Explain that.
Okay, here's how it works. We're starting to enter into this situation that was foreseen long, long ago in the 19th century, where machines would be able to displace people in employment, right? But it's always fake when that happens. Like, the example I like to use to illustrate this is these days you can get your document translated between languages for free.
Right.
You can upload it in English and get it back in Spanish,
right,
from Microsoft or Google or some other places. And you say, wow, it's great. There's this free service. But it's not real. It's a fake. What it really is those services collect real translations done by real human beings, and they collect them without paying for them, without even notifying the people that they were collected. They just do it by scraping the internet. And then they do statistical correlations between passages in your document and previously translated ones. And then they create a mashup of those correlations. And that's your translation. So the thing is, behind the curtain, there are all these real people who are translators who aren't being paid anymore. So anytime you see automation displacing somebody, it's a fake. What's really going on is the software, the data that actually drives whatever machine is doing the job was taken from people who, and we're pretending they don't exist. So it's this idea of automation is really a form of disenfranchisement. Now, we never knew it was going to be like that. There was a time when we thought we really could make electronic brains that were totally freestanding, but that idea has never worked out. What's worked out instead is big data, and big data only comes from real people. There aren't some like angels or supernatural beings that provide it.
So the notion is implicit, because our goal here is to, in our conversation, to try to craft plan for rebuilding middle-class jobs.
So we're going to fix everything right
here
today.
We're going to engage with it.
We're really going to engage with it.
We're not going to necessarily solve the magic pill answer, but we're going to try to take it a step forward. So implicit in what this is though there is all of this unpaid work, and cosmically it is just that folks get paid for everything from every time they make a Facebook like, which helps a company, to writing a review on Amazon, to translating something, to anything. There is intellectual property in this information economy. There's intellectual property that people give and are unpaid for, and cosmically that's unjust. The question is, how can you coerce or voluntarily get companies to go create this ridiculously complicated system for figuring out who deserves what amount of money and pay them, et cetera? Is that really a way to restore income to the middle class?
Yeah, well, look, this is a big, complicated set of issues, and I want to try to set a middle course here where I really do think I know a few things, but I also don't want to claim to know everything.
Right.
And it's very hard to assert that because a lot of people want to say you know nothing, or they want to believe you know everything. And I'm in between there.
This is public radio. We're the land of nuance here. We're not the land of black and white.
Okay, so here's what I do know. The first thing I'll tell you three things I know, actually. All right. One thing I know is that to create a system that would keep track of where the bits came from, would actually be simpler than what we're doing now. It's actually, the original design of the internet was like that, starting with Ted Nelson's work back in the 1960s, where you'd keep track of who contributed what and then be able to send them micropayments. What we do now is insane, where we have to, thousands of different companies have to constantly be scraping the internet, and everybody's scrambling to get in each other's way to control this thing we call advertising, which is really micro manipulation. Instead, you know, it's a nutty, complicated system. So what I'm proposing would almost certainly actually be simpler, not more complicated. It might, you know, so that's a technical question, but I'm pretty good at this stuff, and I think it would work out to be simpler. The second thing I know is that if we could charge for information, it would change the incentive structure of people who are successful in the economy. The reason I know that is that over the summer, I've been working with a wonderful graduate student from Stanford as an intern, Eric Huang, and also a very recognized economist, Brian Arthur, to just take the most established and accepted models of the insurance industry, just as an example, and add a price for information and see what it does. And what's interesting about it is, When you get free information so that you know who to not insure, then you end up with tons of uninsured people. When you have to pay for that information, it balances out, and you have both. This is what's really interesting. You have more insured people, but you also have more stability and more economic growth overall. So actually, even the insurance company does better in the end. And that's where I get to the third thing I know, which is that the way to incentivize people to enter into a system where you're not just stealing information from people all the time is that it'll create more economic growth, and actually people will do better, even the big companies. Because right now what we're doing is we're saying that we're entering an information economy, except that all the value of the information is thrown off the books. It's not recorded anymore. And so what that results in is our economic growth isn't reflecting our improved technological ability, because we're saying it's not economic. And that's really, really stupid. Like, if you're going to have a market economy, you better really do it. And what we're doing is we're trying to have a market economy without having the complete accounting of information in the information age, and it just can't work.
There's no question that there is this unaccounted for productivity and this unaccounted for work. The question that I want to ask is, if I am Google, mm-hmm. and I am responsible to my shareholders, I want to create more profit, how are you going to convince me, even if the system I can create is doable, if the investment is worth it, are you going to try to appeal to my cosmic justice that you're ripping off people by not paying them? How am I going to make the economic argument to Google to say, yes, you should pay all these people?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not that hard to make the argument to Google. And by the way, I'm not anti-Google at all. I sold a company to Google. I'm part of me is at Google. I have a lot of friends there. They're great, actually. They're very sweet people. So what I would say to Google is really simple. You're eating your own tail. You're destroying yourself gradually. Like, if the original idea was, we'll give away some stuff for free in order to advertise the other stuff that isn't free, let's look at that other stuff. The more advanced technology becomes, that other stuff that will actually be paid, that can generate the advertisements you make your money from, is going to start to shrink. Like, if you say, hey, the musician should give away the music, but they can sell the t-shirt, but then pretty soon there'll be some home 3D printer that just spits out everything, including t-shirts. So that goes away, and there'll be automated cars and automated nurses and all these things. There'll be nothing left to advertise if you continue down this path. So what you're doing is you're destroying yourself gradually.
But if I'm Google, I'm thinking, you're giving me a very long-term goal to try to fix society, saying, you know what, by taking all this for free, you're eviscerating American society or the world society, but I need to worry about my next quarter or my next year's profits. Yes, I'm aware of that. And so are you really asking me to go to the next shareholder meeting and telling them, you know, because the middle class is getting hollowed out, and I know all my competitors and Microsoft and Amazon and Apple, they're not doing it, but we want to be the good guys, and so we are going to pay everybody for this. Isn't that going to make the stock drop to zero? Aren't there going to be incredible shareholder lawsuits? Isn't it too long-term a wish to say, go and pay all your people so you can rebuild the middle class? It's going to be a drop in the ocean what they do, what Google does compared to the overall economy.
Well, hey, I haven't noticed Silicon Valley paying much concern to shareholders lately myself. So as long as we do well, the shareholders seem to be able to let us have our way. And I'm sure we will. We're clever. But I'll tell you, I think there's two circumstances that'll make this change in Silicon Valley. One is just age. You know, like right now, the Google folks are starting to get old enough on average to be having kids. Facebook folks tend to be a little bit younger. And so when you're younger and you haven't had kids, your mental model is that you're sort of abstract and infinite, that you'll live forever. And like, why should I have to pay for insurance if I don't need it now? And you're not part of the life cycle. When you start getting older, you become part of the life cycle. And then you start thinking longer term and you start thinking about the future of your kids. And that's actually one of the things I like about the culture of Microsoft, is that since the average age is a little older, there's a bit more of that thinking into the next generations that you find. But then the other thing is, look, this thing is, our society is going to face an unemployment crisis. You know, when cars are driving themselves and we have to tell the Teamsters to disband because there'll be no more truck drivers. I mean, like, that's not next year, 10 years, maybe 20 years. Almost certainly 30 years, absolutely, positively. And so, you know, when that starts to hit and you have massive waves of high-tech driven unemployment, that's when it really has to change.
And a 10 or 20 or 30 year time horizon, mm-hmm, is something that government thinks about, nonprofits think about. I'm running a company, and I need you to make this comment because it doesn't pass my smell test. Let's say I am the president, doesn't matter whether Microsoft or Google, and I know I'm getting tons, millions and billions of dollars of free information from the public. How am I, you're going to pitch to me in plain, simple English, concrete terms, I am Eric Schmidt, and you're going to try to convince me to give away billions of dollars to individuals in an attempt to rebuild the middle class, even though...
No. It's not a giveaway, it's not redistribution, and it's not a social engineering project. It's just complete accounting to create economic growth. This whole idea fails if it hurts the big players. Okay, so here's my attitude about economics. In the Bay Area especially, you run into a lot of leftists who want to have sort of an evened out kind of social program. I don't believe in that because I think it gives too much power to whatever committee is running the social redistribution, and you end up with failure modes, which we've seen in communist countries again and again. This is a long argument, and I know the counter-argument, but anyway, that's what I've come to believe. And then you run into these super libertarians lately, these Ayn Rand people, who believe that you should just, you know, if somebody can't keep up, leave them behind. It doesn't matter. I don't think either of those things leads to a stable, workable society. What you have to have is a society with a strong middle class. The strong middle class gives you the possibility for honest elections that don't get corrupted by the rich. The strong middle class gives you your free market economy because then you have customers for your product. I mean, this is the thing that Ayn Rand people don't realize. If you don't have a strong middle class, you can't have a market economy because you don't have a customer class. And I could go on and on about why the middle class is important. But the key thing is not to make everybody exactly the same middle class. It's to have a distribution so people are free to find different outcomes. So I don't want to pull down the really successful people. I want there to be Elon Musks in the world. And the way to get them is through economic growth. And I think that that's what we can get with complete accounting, so that we allow the information age to reflect the economic growth that's really present.
I need to push this one time further.
Okay.
Complete accounting is fine. So let's say I am Google and I make a complete accounting of all of my true costs.
Yeah.
And in theory, I owe all these millions of people 2 cents for here, 5 cents for this, $10 for that. It's not redistribution. It's pay at some assessment of fair market value. But I'm Eric Schmidt, and I am, in the end, none of these millions of people are sending me a bill for 9 cents. So I've got billions of dollars of money that, in a cosmic sense, I owe to those people, but nobody's sending me a bill for it. And so I am having to pay them billions of dollars. If I am Eric Schmidt, how do you convince me to do that when I don't have to?
Because your income is going to start going down because there won't be a customer class anymore. And that's already starting to happen. I mean, what you're starting to see right now is this ridiculous economy of a sort of a race to control and arrows of trade, or sort of like a blackmail economy here. So, for instance, there's a thing called ad block, which people can install to control, mm-hmm, the ads. But then now suddenly ad block becomes the gatekeeper, and it can let through only quote unquote the useful ads. So now it can demand a sort of a bribe from Google to let Google stuff through. And then there'll be something else that gets in front of ad block. And there's this crazy race to be the most in control of the channel. That's not actual productivity. And that's what we're forcing ourselves into. And Google has to see that at the end of the day, that kind of economy will kill it. No matter how successful they might be at the moment.
Over 10 to 30 years, and they can't afford that kind of time horizon. Let's turn to another area. Nanopayments clearly is not, there is no magic answer to rebuilding jobs in the middle class, but that's a core concept within your book, Who Owns the Future? By the way, listen to KALW, I work with Marty Nemko. I'm talking with Jared Lanier, who is one of my favorite thinkers in the world, and the author of a book called Who Owns the Future, I want to turn to more broadly. So we agree that nanopayments may or may not be a part of the solution to rebuilding the middle class, but I want to be more broad. I want to have fun
here.
Okay,
sure.
And here is the fun question. You have fiat power over the United States of America, but you are a benevolent despot, and you want to impose one change on American society that would help rebuild the middle class apart from nanopayments. What would be your first edict?
So nanopayments are not allowed.
They can be allowed. They're fine. Let's agree that that's part of the solution. So it is allowed.
Well, because I think the way to have an extremely high-tech society that we can create in this century that doesn't disempower and disenfranchise huge numbers of people is simply to acknowledge the contributions that those people make. Another little research project that's ongoing is to figure out how much people's information is actually worth right now. And here's an example of how you can tell. Like if you use a Safeway club card or anything similar with another company or airline frequent flyer, the differential between what you'd be paying if you entered into their information system or if you didn't is the value of your information.
Sure.
All right. If you add up all that stuff, so I've been trying to hypothesize like the most boring and useless possible individual to figure out what the baseline is for how much everybody's worth in our society.
Right.
And it's already, I believe even the most boring person is worth a few $100 a year already.
Okay. Sure.
Just because they contribute to the databases for marketing and planning and all kinds of things. But an average person is getting up into the low thousands, and that's going up year by year. So the really interesting thing is when it hits the poverty line, we have a new method to create a decent society that's different from the previous ones that were available to us. Yeah. Can you see that?
Yes, I see that, but that's still back to the nanopayments. So I want to broaden it because that does come back to unpaid information that people provide.
I'm sorry to interrupt. If we're going to have the information age, but we're saying that the information of individuals doesn't count as part of the economy, we either have to go all the way socialist or we have to go to nanopayments so we can have a market economy that includes the information age. To have this sort of halfway thing where we say that information is only valuable for the people who control the best computers to calculate it and everybody else doesn't get any benefit from it directly, and it's all about advertising for whatever hasn't been automated yet, well, that obviously is going to close itself off into a circle and kill itself. So it's not viable. The two solutions I know of right now are socialism, which I think doesn't work, or some kind of nanopayment scheme, which is a really brand new thing, and which I'm sure we don't know enough about yet, but at least that's the path of hope that I see right now.
Great. I'm curious as to your reaction to one of my sources of, again, not magic pill, but legitimate sources of hope. I think that we are too elitist in our K-16 schools. We don't think about what is the most important information or knowledge that people need to have when they graduate. And to me, the one kind of area of knowledge that offers the most potential ripple benefit to society and creating jobs is entrepreneurship. I would argue for a very immersive, interactive, ethical entrepreneurship curriculum K-16 so that we have more people looking for unmet ethical needs and creating ethical businesses to meet those, thereby creating jobs. What do you think about that as a adjunct, let's say, to nanopayment as a way of refilling the hollowed out middle class?
It's a funny thing because entrepreneurship has been a little bit of a winner take all game lately in the sense that I've known a lot of people in Silicon Valley who've become, well, not a lot, but I've known quite a few people who've become billionaires. And I've known a lot of people who were really just as good, but because of the timing or some little quirk or something, didn't. And so it's a mixture of skill and luck. And I'm a little concerned that if we have a program that implies that the opportunity is there when it isn't, it's really just a tease or a lie. So as long as it's coupled to a society that actually offers a commensurate opportunity to people, then I'm all for it. Absent that opportunity, it's not honest.
What if I said that the opportunities exist on many, many levels, for anything from somebody who would start a shoeshine stand or a chain thereof, or at a high level, in biotech, creating an ethical way of looking at genetic enhancement of intelligence or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that indeed, part of ethics is the triple bottom line thing. You're going to treat people, the planet, and, profits fairly. We can.
Well, the key thing is you have to have some form of entrepreneurship in a society such that you end up with a middle class or, a big hump in the middle of outcomes. Otherwise, it's not sustainable. And right now, the way we're doing things, it's winner take all. So, and that forces people to either become super successful or to work at very low wages. I mean, there's really not a middle in that system.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Jaron Lanier, author of Who Owns the Future. We're trying to grapple with the not easy question of how to rebuild the middle class without presenting pat, kind of frankly, commercial talk radio quick answers. Why am I bringing up commercial talk radio at this point? Because this is the time we need to turn to you. If you value public radio, the deeper discourse that you heard on the previous show, Philosophy Talk, or what we're talking about here, the hard, thorny questions of how to rebuild the middle class jobs, as well as the practical stuff that I try to provide by doing 3-minute career makeovers, 3-minute workovers, this is the time we need you. And I guess I'd like at this point to introduce Matt Martin, station manager. Why should people contribute to KALW at this moment?
Well, should contribute at this moment because they're listening first. If you're someone who cares enough to tune in and find something valuable here, it's worth considering what it's worth to you and how you can make sure it's here for everybody. So that's just a basic one. But the other one is that I think that I think of these last 2 hours of Philosophy Talk and now your conversation with Jaron, and it's that willingness to really go hammer and tongs at the ideas, to really question and challenge and go around and say, hey, from these different perspectives, how do we take on tough questions? That to me is exciting. That to me is a reason to tune in. And simply, if you're someone who has valued that and also valued the really practical advice that Marty brings to the air week in and week out, this is a great time to give. We have Jaron's book, Who Owns the Future, yours for a $120 contribution. I have read most of it, going back and forth on BART. Really appreciated the insights there. I think just in this first 20 minutes, Jaron has given you some things to chew about you're not hearing in other places, just a different way to think about the information economy to begin with. That's fascinating stuff. That's what we hope we provide on a daily basis to you. And if it's true, we ask for a call at 800-525-9917. 800-525-9917. Or you can see thank you gifts like Jaron's book at our website, KALW.org.
One other thank you gift that it is my personal way of giving to you, because I really do honor the privilege of working here and meeting you and talking to you. I periodically offer as a thank you present, a gift or whatever you want to call it, brunch. So you get to meet Barbara, my wife, who frequently is my co-conspirator on the show. And come to brunch here on October 6th. Come see the show. We're going to be talking about Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, iconic book for women and the people around them. It's really a wonderful networking opportunity, wonderful fun, wonderful opportunity for you to get a 3-minute career makeover from me, wonderful opportunity to say what you like and don't like about the show. For $150, you get to come to brunch with Barbara and me on October 6th here at KALW, and it's $250 for a couple. It's a bargain. 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-KALW-917. And if you don't want to talk to our friendly volunteers, all you need to do is go to KALW.org. And one of the things we try to do here is keep the breaks short, because we know you want them short. Back to you, Jaron Lanier. So I want to turn it back to you. Dear listeners, if you're just joining us now, we are talking about one of the hardest problems that society faces, how to rebuild the middle class, middle class jobs particularly, because this show is about jobs. We spent the first 20 minutes talking about Jaron's concept of nanopayments, getting people paid for the work that they do, almost sometimes inadvertently, and a full accounting. Although there are problems with it, I proposed an idea, which is to make ethical K-16 or K-20 entrepreneurship education something that would create good quality jobs. I want to go back. We're kind of alternating back and forth. What's one idea that you want to trot by me for how to rebuild the middle class, especially jobs?
Well, look, let me give you an example of of how we get into a winner-take-all situation in the digital age. Before the internet worked, there were encyclopedias before the Wikipedia, and they had names like the Encyclopedia Britannica or the Encyclopedia Americana. And the interesting thing about them is they had names, and the names expressed a point of view, and there were multiple ones. But once we had the Wikipedia, there's this idea that there can be a single master encyclopedia for all kinds of topics that really have a point of view. And so point of view is obliterated and you have this monoculture. But the other thing is, if there's only one, there's no room for competition. And there's really, it's the only game in town. So therefore, somebody who becomes a major Wikipedian and adds a tons of things, doesn't even occur to them to sort of join a union or demand a wage, because mm-hmm. where else are they going to mm-hmm. go? It removes their options. So this monoculture forces this winner-take-all situation. And we see the same thing in field after field. It's not just the Wikipedia. It's going to be software and robotics and 3D printers and self-driving cars and on and on. So the only way out of it is to somehow find a way that people who contribute, who don't have the traditional means of using competition, because there are multiple games in town. There's only one game in town in this digital world, whatever that game is. We have to have them give them a way to benefit, such that enough of them benefit that there's a middle class so that you have customers. Otherwise, the market system will go away and it'll just be some gigantic plutocracy of nutty people. It'll be a small plutocracy, but super empowered and super rich. And so the way to avoid that is to somehow find a way that those people do well. And like I say, you either have a socialist committee that redistributes, which I think doesn't work, or you just do honest accounting because they actually did contribute. So to me, you know, the decision space is kind of small and the result is somewhat obvious. I just think people haven't gotten used to that yet.
What I find very interesting is your frequent use in this discussion of the winner-take-all concern,
mm-hmm.
the exacerbation of gap between haves and have-nots.
Right.
So, and that was your counter to my suggestion about, you know, entrepreneurship education, because it might lead to yet more exacerbation of the gap. Let's try a liberal...
No, I'm way into entrepreneurial education, provided that the system is such that on average, somebody can be entrepreneurial and get an average result. If what actually happens is the average entrepreneur ends up being shunted into the bottom and only a tiny, tiny portion end up doing well, then obviously the whole thing was a waste.
I want to offer a more liberal adjunct to this, which is this. You know, you're talking about too many people are likely to be winner-take-all. Is it too likely that we're not going to have the average folk being able to get at least an average outcome? Legitimate points. And that is the reason for, to use the word you shunned earlier, redistribution. What if I said that really, in any kind of a capital, the benefits of capitalism have a big downside, which is that there are some significant number of losers, especially in a very information-centric, demanding economy. Therefore, is this not the time for a WPA2, a redistributive plan where people who can't make it in the market economy are at taxpayer expense given jobs to beautify San Francisco, to be elder companions, to shut in people, to be tutors in schools? Is it not time for a work project administration too, a la Franklin Roosevelt?
Yeah. You know, I have to say those kinds of programs have worked out very well in some cases, like the WPA, but to sustain them over time does tend to create dictatorships because somebody gets control of them. You know, I mean, that's like the first generation of Marxists in Russia was actually this really cool intellectual generation. And then you had Stalin, and you see that. I mean, I've even seen that in like little miniature experiments just in the Bay Area when I've lived in group houses or something like that. It's just very hard to sustain. And the other thing about it is there's an issue with human nature that people have some kind of elemental clannishness, and it's very hard to sustain social programs in a multicultural environment. It creates these tensions. Like you see it breaking down in Europe as Europe becomes multicultural, and there's like a deep issue there that's not going to be resolved in 100 years. That's a 1,000-year kind of problem. And I'm not opposed to another WPA, but if that's the solution that's supposed to last forever, it'll lead to some sort of Stalinist takeover eventually, because it'll have to get bigger and bigger. And when I'm talking like that, I might sound a little bit like a libertarian, because that's the kind of thing a libertarian would say. But of course, I'm not at all. And I'll also say to the libertarians that if you laissez-faire markets destroy the market, the customer class, and so they also don't work. You know, neither of the traditional solutions work. And the problem I always have is that since I'm trying to propose a third thing, everybody reacts, pardon me, everybody reacts like allergically as if I'm attacking their particular thing, whether it's the left or the right. And I'm really kind of attacking both equally. I'm trying to get to a different place because we do have a new option now.
You talked about something very important. You talked about the challenges that multiculturality imposes in businesses or enterprises. And yet, you know, on one hand, especially we in the Bay Area, will, you know, it's almost if there was a Bay Area motto, it's celebrate diversity. Diversity is our greatest strength, et cetera. You've worked in one kind of great diversity in Silicon Valley. There are more people of various kind of backgrounds, Indians and Asians and Jews and Christians and Muslims. Tell me your thoughts about if we're trying to rebuild the middle class, how do we address as a strength, as a weakness, as a challenge, whatever you want to call it, how do we address the issue of multiculturality in your thoughts?
Well, it's interesting. One of the biggest differences in Silicon Valley that's, you know, versus 30 years ago is that in terms of ethnicity and national background, it's massively more diverse than it was. And, you know, there are a huge number of Indians and Chinese and Russians and Israelis and everybody you could imagine.
Iranians.
In my immediate lab group, we have both Israelis and Iranians and Palestinians and Russians and Chinese and everybody. I mean, it's great. We have Pakistanis and Indians working together, and it's wonderful in that sense. But you know what I feel is that we have a loss of what I'd call cognitive diversity, in that we're all nerdy boys. You know, like there's a certain kind of mindset that works really well with the particular digital technology of our age that tends to overwhelm every other cognitive style. And I feel like I'm a little bit of a style shapeshifter, so I can be the nerdy boy and I can also be elsewhere, so I can get a bit of perspective on it. And I'm a little concerned that we're building a society that so favors that particular cognitive style that it's excluding other ones. And so we are building one kind of diversity but losing another kind, which might even be more precious, actually.
You know, you work at Microsoft Research, kind of a think tanky place. And if you were to add one category of human being, it wouldn't be nerdy boy. What would be the, and there was, let's say, there was a slot at the seat at the table, and seven of you sitting at the table, and let's say there are six nerdy boys, and you had one slot that you could reallocate. What category of human being would you add and why?
Gosh, I think somebody who's somebody in a helping profession who goes out into the field in difficult circumstances and knows the
social
real world.
Social worker type.
Something like that. Yeah, I married a social worker.
There you go.
somebody who goes out there and deals with the real world even when it's difficult and can understand the difference between reality and ideals.
All right. Let's turn to another suggestion. I'll give you a choice. Do you want to propose another fiat that you would make as the czar of America to try to rebuild the middle class? You want to hear one from me? It's up to you.
No, you go. You go.
Okay. So you didn't like the WPA very enough because you were afraid of its socialist tendencies and that they would eventually create a plutocracy.
As a temporary thing, it's great. And by the way, our particular WPA left us with a wonderful legacy of places and art and all kinds of things. So AWPA, but to have WPA as the solution is a very different thing. So that, you know, a small order WPA, I think, would be great right around now.
All right.
Yeah.
I want to go to a more private sector variation on this, non-coercive. There, some of the most rewarding but underpaid work is what I call the assistance army. People who are, let's say, you mentioned nerds. So, you know, there's a million people, young and old, who still are kind of tech light. And they would love to be able to do a better job of using their computer. They use 2% of what their computer does. They don't know how to use a home monitoring system. They don't use their smartphone very well. There's all kinds of technology. So that's one little example of an assistance army. People, and we don't think of hiring somebody to come in and be our personal geek. We don't, if we have a new baby, yes, maybe for the first few weeks we might hire somebody to come in and help out. But, you know, in-home care is not used very much by many people. They just don't think about it. Or a homework helper for your child, and going up the chronological ladder, a homework helper for your child, somebody who's going to help you land a job, who's going to make the phone calls for you and initial phone calls to try to land a job. An elder, my mom is old, you know, elder companions who are going to come in there to provide support. I think that a PR campaign, probably government run, to bring into top of mind the notion that people could hire members of people that would constitute an assistance army would dramatically improve the quality of life for humankind and create a lot of jobs without a redistributive model. What do you think?
Well, I'll tell you what I observe right now. I'm all for people paying each other for how they help each other. I think that if we're going to have a market economy at all, it should be as complete a market economy as possible so people benefit from it. The problem is that right now, the sort of have and have not dynamic in our economy is so great that what happens is the people who are on the good side of it, on the top, in the 1% or whatever, tend to become so competitive about getting that kind of help, the best tutors, the best live-in home care. I mean, I see this just where I live. I'm a 1%er, I suppose, and just what I see in the people around me is this incredible competition that recreates the winner-take-all phenomenon in the helping professions. So you have you'll have a few tutors who are so in demand that nobody can get appointments from them, and their rates become insanely high. And then you have this sort of ocean of people who sort of are struggling. So it just what it does is it just reflects the basic economic structure.
Would what I'm proposing ameliorate that? Because if more people were searching for tutors for their kid or classroom teachers uh-huh. who out of their own pocket are willing to bring somebody into the classroom or somebody more elder care, you would have more people making more money because the demand for such people would more. Is that not right? Wouldn't that be redistributive?
Well, you know, the thing is, over time, it has a shot. I mean, I do believe it. The other thing I wanted to say is that people think of the helping professions as being the ones that will be immune from being automated, but I'm not sure that's true. You know, in Japan, they have this tremendous problem of an aging population without enough young people coming in to balance it. And they also love robots and think of robots as cute and friendly, and they have thought that way for years. And so the progress they're making in elder care robots is genuinely impressive. And if you move it ahead 10 years, you might be able to like import a cheap robotic helper that isn't as good as a really good human helper, but on the other hand, doesn't have the risks of a bad human helper, and it's so hard to find the right people and all that, and people might... I could see automation playing a much larger role than people imagine.
Exactly, and that's one of what scares the hell out of me. So that, for example, I was at a fancy restaurant last night, and I don't like fancy restaurants. I just find them effete and silly. But the waiter was like one big annoyance. Oh, how are we proceeding now with our dinner? And you know, I'm showing. I'll be taking care of you tonight. And like I wanted to, and he swept away the crumbs from the stupid table, right? And I had to pay him 15% to 20% for the privilege of that. Well, you know, there are now many restaurants, not at the high end yet, but that are replacing waiters with tablets with you know iPads, and people simply get to see more. They see the items. They get more information about the items, and they don't need to deal with the waiter. Let him pay him 20. Are we not going to be automating everything from waiters laundry machines to 3D manufacturing of clothing and recycling?
I think we will. But the thing you have to remember is that all of these systems can only run based on big data, and big data only comes from people. There is no artificial intelligence other than the rehashing of real people. And so even if the wait service at restaurants becomes automated, there's some way that your information is going to be used for some other automation. It'll be different for each person. But somehow, if we just track that down, and this isn't some mystical divining of what somebody's information is worth. This is just tracking down where the bits came from and then how much the service ended up being worth. It's a very concrete idea. If we just do that, most people will find that they'll be in a middle class of an economy that results from that. That, you know, it's a very simple idea at its core.
We kind of flashed quickly about 3D manufacturing and clothing and how that's going to kill jobs. Fled, explain how 3D manufacturing will likely kill the clothing industry.
Well, I don't know exactly what year these various things will happen, but there's a hobbyist craze now called 3D printing. I'm sure a lot of listeners have played with it. It's great fun. You have a thing that looks like a microwave, and you give it a file that you can download for free off the internet, and these little nozzles print out a 3D object for you, some kind of, it could be a piece of jewelry or whatever. And right now, it's pretty simple. It's mostly like little plastic items of one color, but eventually it could be a whole tablet. And so at that point, the Apple Store goes away. You don't go there anymore, except maybe for help or something, and you just print your new object. Same thing for clothes. And you might ask, well, why would you want to do that? Well, for one thing, it's vastly cheaper and more efficient. It's more environmentally sound. You don't have transportation anymore. But also, if you printed it in the first place, you know how to recycle it with precise efficiency because you'll know exactly what's in it. So you can unwind it to create a near perfect recycling.
And it's customized. You can put your exact measurements in, and you gain 3 pounds, and you can get new exactly the same style if you love it and it fits.
So that's the wrong thing to say for what I was about to say next, which is you never have to wear the same dress twice. But it might not be because you gained weight. But at any rate. But you can see where this is going. It kills Walmart. It kills Amazon. It kills China because the whole manufacturing base of China becomes much less important if people can just print on site what they need. And it gives rise to a new superpower of whoever supplies the gloops. That it'll be a new kind of oil. There'll be some new titan of controlling the gloop. Antecedent elements that go into 3D printing, but it will just be a massive destroyer of jobs everywhere. It'll destroy retail here and manufacturing in China.
Dear listeners, I hope you appreciate we're trying. You know, so often there is woe is me shows about the middle class, and then there are those that are Pollyanna present magic solutions. We are trying, as is very consistent with public radio, to provide nuance. If you like nuance in public radio and you like not commercials, you like almost all of the funding that comes to this radio station does not come from big entities. They come from you. So if you like work with Marty Nemco, if you like public radio, and especially this is your only time, by the way, you know, there's not going to be another pledge drive for another membership drive for eight months. So if you like work with Marty Nemco and KALW Public Radio, this is your time. The number, 1-800-525-9917. We have thank you gifts for $120. You will get an autographed copy of Jaron Lanier's fabulous, mind-bending book about the internet and the future of jobs, who owns the future. And for $150, you can come to meet me, which I love to do, and you will find it fun and rewarding to meet Barbara, my wife, Barbara Nemco, and me on October 6th here. Watch the show and then have brunch with us. $150 for one person, $250 for a couple, 1-800-525-9917. Nice volunteers there. 1-800, it'll only take a minute. Credit cards, payments, we make it easy. 1-800-525-9917 or go to KALW.org. And it's now my pleasure to reintroduce station manager Matt Martin.
We're really a human scale operation here at KALW. That's one of the reasons why when Marty says, hey, come and meet me and Barbara, see what the place is like, talk to us about things that matter to you. Mm-hmm. And it's also why we have a conversation like this, which isn't, you know, of course, everyone's interested in what the future of the economy is. But the focus of the conversations here at KALW is what will it mean for people? And as individuals, as families, as communities, how do we try to find a way to steer it in a way that is human and positive? That is what you support, these kind of conversations where, as Marty said, the questions, we don't always know the answer to these questions. And what I love about Jaron Lanier is he's somebody, when Marty poses a question to him, I have no idea where he's going to take it, what context he's going to bring into it. That is the kind of conversation you support here on KALW. A few people have already gotten in touch this morning. Susan Harvey in San Francisco, Rachel Ibora also here in the city, and Peter Roll in Mill Valley. Thank you for taking the time to be part of local public radio. 800-525-9917. Great thank you gifts to offer. We're not taking time out to talk about them. You can go to the website or talk to a phone volunteer.
Yep. 1-800-525-9917. And I'm going to simply for now say thank you for listening and supporting work with Marty Nemco. I really care about you. I also care about my guest, Jaron Lanier, who's going to share some more ideas. We're going to have more ideas here that we'd like to share, both for how individuals can survive in this difficult and ever difficult job market, as well as the macro. I want to either give you a chance to provide one more different suggestion, having nothing to do with full accounting or payments, that you would do to improve middle class jobs, or if you're out of ideas, so now I'm happy to run one more by myself. What would you like?
No, you go. Go. Let me hear more.
I like to think that one of the things, and this is the liberal side of me, that mm-hmm. has made America worse is the primacy of materialism. And if, in fact, fewer people, in this age of unfull accounting of volunteer efforts and the ever more automation and offshoring and part-timing and temping and all that stuff, more people, the reality is more Americans are going to be earning less money. And therefore, it is wise for them to learn that you can not only live okay on much less, but that you can live better if you look to your relationships, to your social contribution, to your creative outlets, to your intellectual productivity as more rewarding than buying another piece of crap, another pair of shoes, a newer car, you know, any of that stuff. That educating the one of the most important parts of creating a middle class that is content and not ready to revolt is realizing that one can often live better on less if you change your value, what you value, than those rich fat cats living in 4,000 square feet in Danville having their fifth martini. What do you think about that?
What if there's a loyal listener in Danville? What's that person going to think?
Screw him.
Okay. So, Danville's fine. I have friends in Danville. Okay. You know, it's a really interesting question. The first thing to say is I think research has shown that if you get to a basic threshold where your needs are met, you don't really get happier if you get richer than that.
Right.
And in a decent society, you wouldn't get healthier either. You know, if your basic, like, there should be a threshold at which your basic needs are met. And I certainly think that in a society as skillful as ours and with the technology we have and the wealth we have, we should have everybody at that level. I don't think we should have everybody at the same level. I'm a strong believer in individuality. You know, I think some people might want to, I have a fetish for finding unusual musical instruments, and I like being able to get them, you know, and it is probably a little sick on some level. I don't know, but whatever. I'm not perfect. But, you know, I do agree this. I see a lot of very unhappy sort of upper middle class people who wish they were really rich and just consume like crazy and get all new cars all the time and these fancy houses and all this stuff. And there is something that does feel a little out of kilter about it. Yeah. So you know, what the ideal we always wanted in Silicon Valley when I used to talk about ideas like this with my friends years ago was that wealth should matter less. Like, at the point where there's just a lot of technology around and there's like doctor robots that are free. So you, in exchange for seeing an ad for a cafe, you get your cancer fixed by some doctor robot in 30 years or something like that. That was the idea. So that it really wouldn't matter. But the problem is that vision doesn't make sense. It actually does matter. We are seeing a state in the United States where if you're rich, your kids have much greater prospects. If you're rich, you'll live longer. It really isn't true that rising technology makes the differences between wealth and poverty go away, unfortunately. If that were happening empirically, I'd say, okay, there's our answer. We just don't worry about it anymore. But that's not what's actually happening. So, I think people beyond, you know, there's some level, which we don't even have a good word for, but some level of maybe the living wage or the decent standard of living or something where you're not in terror of falling off a cliff all the time. When you hit that, maybe you don't really need to be richer than that, or at least a lot of people don't, to be happy and to be successful. But right now, that's not the society we're in.
Let's spend the last part of the time getting down to the ground level, you know, boots on the ground level, a Syrian term. You said in your book, Who Owns the Future, that a survival strategy for people, for some people, is to simply work for the siren servers. Explain what siren servers are and why that's at least a short-term survival strategy for some people.
Sure. A siren server is one of the biggest and most effective computers and a computer network. So if everybody's sharing information openly, that doesn't mean everybody's equally empowered. That was a huge mistake my friends and I made in the old days. What actually happens is whoever has the biggest computer or the best computer can outcompute everyone else using the same data. So like, you have access to a lot of the same data Google does, but you can't compete with Google because Google has these giant city-sized, you know, computers everywhere calculating. And so those are the siren servers. Some of the siren servers are on Wall Street. They run the high-frequency schemes, and they ran the leveraged mortgage securities that led to the Great Recession. Some of the Siren servers are in Silicon Valley, the Facebooks and the Googles. Some of the Siren servers are the National Intelligence. We didn't even get into the NSA and all that, but that's another Siren server, and it follows just the same patterns. It's exactly
By the way,
same.
The term Siren, explain it. It comes from Greek philosophy.
It comes from Homer, yeah. I try to bring in history, so, you know. The Sirens were these sort of female apparitions that would lure sailors to crash on the rocks. But the interesting thing about Sirens is they didn't actually physically attack the sailors. Like, if a sailor could just keep a straight head, they wouldn't pose any danger. And that's how I feel about computation. Like, it's not, like, all this stuff is just us fooling ourselves and screwing ourselves up. There's no reason for it. So if we can just get clear-headed about it and realize that we're getting confused, we don't have to have these problems of losing the middle class just because technology is getting better.
I want to be sure that we're not too elitist here. The reality is that most human beings are not hireable by Google, Apple, or any of the Siren servers. If I was your brother and I am scared, I'm one of the millions of people who got laid off, part-time, automated, and I'm average. I'm not retarded. I mean, that's not the word. I'm not developmentally disabled is the current term. But I am a normal, average, soft-skilled person.
Right.
I've got people skills. I'm nice. I'm organized. I show up on time. But I can't program an assembly language. I can't even program an HTML5. So, you know, Python scares me. So what advice do you have for me, a typical normal person?
Yeah, well, you know,
job-wise.
Let me answer it on two levels. In terms of the proposal, my big proposal for a micropayment-based society, I believe if we look into, even for an average person, how much their information is already worth to the people who are making use of it, it's on the way up, and it might get them to the poverty line, I think, within a decade or less, you know. So people shouldn't undersell themselves. Even if you're not being paid, you are providing value and you are being used, even if you're just sitting around. It's a weird thing. That's how our society works today. That's how big data works. But in terms of what to do today, it's hard. It's hard because we are in an era where things are concentrating and you have to somehow pony up to somebody with a big computer. And it's true that with each generation of computer technology, there are in a way fewer of those positions. You know, you had Microsoft has, I think now with Nokia, God, it's got to be 120,000, 130,000 people or something. But Google is much less and Facebook is much less and Instagram is 13 people worth $1 billion. And it's like...
Right.
It's becoming more and more concentrated, so it's tough. It's not a general solution, but you know, for a lot of people, it is the solution.
Let me propose a solution I think is more applicable more broadly.
Okay.
Status is ultimately a foolish game to go after. We tend to go over the radar. We think of tech and biotech and entertainment and all those and the environment and all those hot fields. But there are millions of jobs that nobody aspires to who's ever graduated even from San Francisco State, let alone from Stanford. So if I was an average person, I would probably look under the radar to everything from working in perfectly honorable businesses like sandblasting, used truck part brokerage, providing an honorable little shoeshine stand that doesn't cost much to start, and yet it's all profit. I would look under the radar. I would consider status my enemy.
Yeah. Well, look, a couple things to say about that. All those kinds of jobs might be automated away and become taken over by robots at some point in this century, and I would suspect 10 or 20 years. But in the near term, I agree with you. And by the way, I'm a bit old for some of that stuff now, but I enjoyed some of my jobs earlier. I paid for college by having a goat dairy, and I had to milk those goats every morning and make cheese, then make the rounds selling it.
I drove a taxi cab when I was in college.
Yeah, you know, and I think people who haven't experienced physical work and that kind of responsibility are missing something in their lives, you know, because I have a lot of students these days who really have never even come within a mile of anything like that. And I think there's a loss in that.
Well, certainly our listeners have had no losses, I think, in spending this hour with Jaron Lanier. My guest has been Jaron Lanier, the author of Who Owns the Future, a really interesting polymath guy. I do commend the book. I swear to you, I really read this whole book and found my brain turned inside out all the time as I was reading. And yet he manages to be accessible. This is not some arcane theory driven. It's very practical, filled with anecdotes, and I commend it to you. And you can get an autographed copy of it, and the good feeling of joining public radio, and
every dollar you pledge, you donate, is a vote for Work with Marty Nemco. And unvarnished truth, how much money the dear listeners donate right now, because this is the last 2 minutes, helps determine whether I stay on the air. So if you like Work with Marty Nemco and you would like to support public radio and Work with Marty Nemco, 1-800-525-9917. The basic membership, I think, is $75. The for $120, you get an autographed copy of Jaron Lanier's book. And for $150, you get to come. You know, I don't, some people would pay not to meet me, but you could just tell the people you want to pay $150 to not meet Marty Nemco. You can do that, but you can meet my wife Barbara Nemco and I and watch the show, have brunch with us. It's totally fun. 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917, or go to KALW.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce one last time. We got 3 minutes left. Matt Martin, station manager, KALW.
3 minutes before the show, we're keeping the programming intact. So you have a full hour of Marty and Jaron Lanier in conversation. Before we go to the show, we need to fill those lines up to say, yes, let's support this different way of doing fundraising that leaves the programming intact. Yes, let's keep this membership campaign to just 7 days. And most importantly, let's keep programming that's exploratory, that's humane, on the air. Your support makes it happen. 800-525-9917, KALW.org, 800-525-9917. There shouldn't be one line that's not lit after this hour. To me, this is the kind of really interesting conversation, the kind of voices you want to bring to the air. If you have been listening and you have been waiting, do not wait. Be part of it. Before we go to the show, great stories and ideas throughout the afternoon. Your support keeps it coming.
Yeah. Matt Martin, you know, really, honestly, you don't always agree with everything I do on this radio show.
That is absolutely true.
It's absolutely true. And yet you've chosen to keep it on the air. Why? Because that may be the same kind of reasons that people might want to pick up the phone and donate to KLW.
Fundamentally, I don't think we should have, I mean, to me, if you come on and have an honest conversation and you also bring on some people with whom you disagree and you're willing to go at it with them and do that respectfully, I think that has a place on the air. And I also think you bring on really great people to talk and you have honest dialogues with people about their work. That to me is valuable. I'm happy to have that be part of the mix here at KALW. Sometimes it means I come into some angry emails on a Monday morning. That's part of my job. Your support keeps this mix together at 800-525-9917. Very honestly, that's where I come from about it.
Makes perfect sense. And if you or someone you love maybe has gotten a little help from my 3-minute career makeovers, if you want to support probably one of the only shows in America about work that really focuses both on you and the big picture, this is the last time, I swear. The show is over. So if you want to support Work with Marty Nemco, every dollar is a vote for Work with Marty Nemco and public radio, intelligent radio. 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917, or you can make your pledge at KALW.org. I would love to meet you for brunch. We really do have fun. And now I simply want to say thank you to you, my dear listeners, to Jaron Lanier for coming in, to Matt Martin for your support for all these years. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my border operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers. That is a core function of the show. And I'll talk with Jim Huntington on the same critical topic. He's the author of Work's New Age, The End of Full Employment, and What It Means to You. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.